On a Friday at the end of May, we will wrap up the past 5 days, of course. There's also some economic data, a little wanderlust, and some Texas honky-tonks, too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, the 29th day of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Yeah, it was only 4 days of work this week for most of us, I guess, but it did feel kind of long. You know, lots to talk about, so we are going to get right on it. Gina Smilek is at the New York Times. Neil Richardson is at Edward Jones. Hey, you two.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Neil, let me start with you, and with the caveat that we're going to have Nancy Marshall-Genzer here in a minute talking about personal income, I want to get your take as the trained economist in the room on the 13-point-something% drop in consumer spending in the past month, and I want you to frame it in terms of, well, consumers are basically this entire economy. Now what do we do?
Right. The consumers are the engine of growth for the economy, but the consumer has been staying at home. Many of us are under lockdown orders that are just now starting to ease. And so what we've seen is this phased in transition from a near lockdown of the national economy in April to a phased reopening that's happening in stages. And so consumer spending is under the weight of that lockdown in terms of, well, there's nothing to spend our money on besides basic goods, but also some fear about re-engaging with the economy without social distancing protection. And so the key to the recovery will be that consumers feel healthy both physically and financially to get back to spending at their normal levels.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that a little bit with Nancy Marshall-Genzer here in a minute. Gina, I want to ask you sort of along those same lines. Fed Chair Jay Powell did a thing today with Ellen Blinder at Princeton, sort of a Q&A. It was a very nice little chat with those two guys who've obviously known each other forever. But one of the things Ellen Blinder said, he's a professor of economics at Princeton, he said, look, you guys are crossing some red lines in this crisis. And Powell came back and said, yeah, you know what? I'm okay with that because this time is different. I thought that was a remarkable thing for the guy running the American economy to say.
I think it is remarkable. You know, he basically said, this is an emergency unlike anything we've ever seen before. And if we didn't cross these red lines, we'd have to explain ourselves to the American people and say, why didn't you do everything you possibly could do to save the economy? So it was a remarkable statement. I think it's really interesting coming from Powell, too, because he has historically been particularly concerned about crossing some of the red lines that the Fed has crossed. Mm-hmm. One of them, for example, is buying municipal debt. You know, that's something they're about to start doing. It's something that he's been asked about before. And in the past, he was always very quick to say, you know, that's a line we don't want to cross, picking winners and losers. And they jumped right into it in this crisis.
Hey, Neela, so Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said today, just sort of on those along those lines of this being, you know, an unprecedented crisis, Senator McConnell said today, you know, the next relief bill, whenever it comes, is probably going to be the last one. Do you buy that?
No, not at all, because we're still in the early transition of the economy. The second quarter is supposed to bear the brunt of the economic toll of COVID-19. Remember, we've already seen a 5% decline in U.S. GDP just on basis of two weeks of a shutdown in late March. So imagine what the second quarter is going to look like. And, you know, much of the stimulus has come at a time when people can't spend because they're staying at home. So I expect that there will be more stimulus. We may see some green shoots of recovery in the second half, and it's likely that we will, but that's going to be in the midst of an uptick in bankruptcies as firms struggle to make this transition, and some longer-term effects in terms of the 40 million people who are now seeking or have unemployment benefits. So there's a long road to recovery, and I don't think we get out of a relief effort from the government that quickly.
So, Gina, you did a piece, I apologize, I don't remember if it was today or yesterday, about the shape of this recovery. And the line that stuck with me is V stands for very unlikely, which I kind of loved. But let's riff on that whole green shoots thing. What do you see out there that gives you hope, if anything?
Right. So I think if there's one hopeful takeaway from that piece I wrote, it's that we're not in for an L. So it's very unlikely that growth just fell off a cliff and it's just going to stay low forever and that's it. Because what we're seeing is that activity is picking up and starting to sort of improve as we kind of get used to living in this world. I think one thing that's important to note is that activity is picking up in places that have reopened, but not in a really markedly different way than it is in places that haven't reopened more fully yet. And so while that's a sign of green shoots, I think it's also a reason to be modest in our expectations about what's going to happen as we reopen. It doesn't seem like people are just sort of pouring back into their old lives with unbounded enthusiasm here.
Yeah. Neela, you buy that? And what green shoot do you like, if any?
Well, first, I think it's the preconditions that we were in prior to the pandemic. It's important to remember that this is a biologically triggered downturn, that the economy wasn't broken going into the outbreak and the pandemic. And so there are several things that were already in place, like a healthy banking system that can support some pretty intense and aggressive Fed action through the banking system. That wasn't the case during the financial crisis. The banks were the problem. We've also seen consumers have relatively healthier balance sheets than they did during the financial crisis in terms of the amount of debt relative to their income. So some of those conditions will help with the economic toll. But right, it's going to be, I think, a slower road than a V shape. And it's going to be based on biological and medical advancements, not just a reopening alone.
Right, right. Which we are seeing. Neela Richardson, she's at Edward Jones. Gina Smilak covers the Fed for the New York Times. Thanks, you two.
Thank you, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
Have a nice weekend. Have a nice weekend as best you can, I suppose. Ending the month on Wall Street today. You know that old saying, sell in May and go away? Yeah, no, there was a whole lot of buying this month. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Our off lead today, as promised in that segment above, comes from the Bureau of Economic Analysis in the form of a regular report on personal income that office does. Incomes in this economy up 10.5% last month. Also in April, of course, 20 million people in this economy lost their jobs. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains what is going on.
At the end of every month, the federal government adds up all the money we've made that month, from wages, interest and dividends, even government benefits. Then the Bureau of Economic Analysis spits out the personal income number, showing how much income went up or down. It doesn't usually make headlines, but the April number made economists' jaws drop.
It tells us that this is a very weird moment.
Jason Furman is a Harvard economist and former chair of the Council of Economic Advisors. He says incomes went up last month because of the $1,200 relief checks most U.S. adults are getting. Plus, the government tacked an extra $600 a week onto unemployment payments.
The government has protected people's incomes from the large decline that otherwise would have been caused by the economy.
U.S. workers have filed more than 40 million unemployment claims since the coronavirus pandemic hit the U.S. Furman says government benefit payments rose in April by a whopping 90%. Ann Owen is an economist at Hamilton College. She says without the government help, the April personal income number falls a lot.
Income for the month of April would have gone down substantially. Instead of being up 10%, we would have been down roughly 5%.
Most of the relief checks have already been sent out. So what will personal income look like for May? Ernie Tedeschi, policy economist at Evercore ISI, says the personal income number for this month will probably make headlines again because it will drop.
Because these stimulus payments are one time. And after they're sent out, they go away. It's not clear if Congress is going to do another round at all, but we're at the end of May. We know that there's not going to be another round in May.
Tedeschi says the government will keep adding the $600 to weekly unemployment payments, but that's set to expire at the end of July. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
We've talked a lot about supply chains in this crisis. Grocery stores, for instance, and some of the challenges getting stuff on shelves there. Overseas sourcing as well and how that has gotten harder. Supply chains are everything, really, which explains why Ford and General Motors, to name just a couple, have started paying their suppliers early to keep them alive and supplying for however long this thing lasts. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has today's coronavirus supply chain primer.
At the beginning of the pandemic, it turns out that some companies started hoarding electrical equipment. Don't ask me. I don't know. People also started hoarding toilet paper. Luke Durkin handles North America strategy for Schneider Electric, which makes all kinds of electrical equipment.
People were panic buying. People were stocking up on electrical infrastructure.
Now, that kind of a surprise is a problem for a business because it sends a shockwave through the supply chain. You got to ramp up, and so do your suppliers.
If a supplier says, yeah, we can take your order, knowing full well they can't fulfill it, you are done.
Now, you might think that in 2020, a business would know if its suppliers' suppliers were running low or if its customers' customers were clamoring for more. But a lot of businesses don't know that.
The COVID-19 pandemic really exposed a lot of the vulnerabilities that we have in our global supply chains.
Katie George is a senior partner at McKinsey.
Think about how Amazon has created this very simple way for us to track our orders. That's a simple kind of tracking mechanism that actually many companies don't have around their own sources of supply.
Some companies now want to set up digital systems to see what's happening in their supply chains. Everything from actual scanners along the way to just sharing data between businesses, something they weren't willing to do often until now. Schneider Electric, though, has been doing it for years.
So we can look at supplier A and say, oh, okay, these guys are at 80% of capacity right now. So they're going to max out. So we should think about maybe placing an order with them, or we should switch to supplier B.
They're also protecting their supply chain physically.
We ordered a mass machine from China. We're actually manufacturing some of our own PPE right now, which we are sharing with our supply chain.
Lots of firms are also supporting their supply chains financially, says Jeff Pratt, who works on supply chain consulting for BDO. He says his clients have talked with their suppliers about how much cash they need and made payments if they had to.
The entire focus was sort of collaborating with the suppliers to get through the situation together and not jeopardize those relationships and providing the appropriate cash flow through the supply chain.
No man is an island and no business is either. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Coming up.
There may be more logistics to consider.
Oh, aren't there always. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, so here's how May goes out. Dow Industrials down 17 points today, less than a tenth percent, closed at 25,383. The NASDAQ up 120 points, 1.2%, finished at 94.89. The S&P 500 up 14, about four-tenths percent, 3,044 there. For the week, the Dow climbed 3.9%, the NASDAQ up 1.7%, the S&P 500 up 3%. Salesforce weakened 3.4% today after the business software maker cut its annual revenue and profit forecasts. I will confess something, if you promise not to tell anybody, I'm still not really clear on what that company does. Bank stocks down, Citigroup and JPMorgan Chase slipped 2.5% apiece, Wells Fargo down 2.7% today. Bond prices rose, yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 0.65%, and you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Okay, to review. Another 2.1 million new claims for unemployment benefits this week. More than 40 million total unemployed since the middle of March. That's about one in four people who had a job in the before times who now don't. Something like 78% of the people, though, who were laid off last month told the Labor Department that they were thinking their layoffs were temporary, that they'd really only been furloughed and would be back at work at some point. That some point, though, is proving elusive. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has more on that.
A lot of jobs aren't coming back yet because a lot of businesses may never come back. Economist Beth Ann Bovino at S&P Global cites a survey by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce back in April that found about a quarter of business owners worried their companies wouldn't survive more than 2 months.
That would mean that jobs that were waiting for those temporary unemployed won't be there.
And, says economist Anne Elizabeth Conkle at the Indeed Hiring Lab, with unemployment already in the double digits,
right now is a particularly tough time to job search because hiring has slowed across the economy overall,
even in some formerly booming sectors. Sanjay Khandwal is 54, and he's worked in high-tech finance jobs. He has two kids in college and a big Silicon Valley mortgage to cover.
I was actually told I was going to be laid off end of February. I reached out very quickly to my network.
He got one interview, then a follow-up.
And they all seemed to go really well. And then I got emails saying, hey, with everything going on, we've just kind of put on a hold.
After that, crickets.
I don't see the job market rebounding very quickly. As it comes back, I do think it will be more difficult for experienced and more expensive workers like me.
Meanwhile, the sectors that are hiring now are offering lower-skilled, lower-paid jobs. Daniel Zhao is with job site Glassdoor.
E-commerce, delivery, supermarkets, these are all industries where demand has even increased during the crisis.
Some workers are coming back from layoff as restaurants, construction sites, and stores reopen. Darius Windley was laid off in April from a restaurant in eastern Nebraska. Then the owner got a paycheck protection loan and reopened.
And so she called me. I think there was only 2 employees out of 7 that were willing to come back. So I went back to work.
He says most of his former coworkers were concerned about getting sick. And online hiring sites report that searches for jobs that can be done remotely have spiked as the pandemic has dragged on. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Here's an item from the Texas Restaurant Association. Bars and restaurants and honky-tonks in the Lone Star State have lost $600 or so million dollars in revenue since they were shut down. Those places were clear to open up a week ago with certain conditions, 25% capacity inside, no limits for patios. Tables, of course, set 6 feet apart. Also, no dancing. Bars, of course, are kind of made for close quarters, so how in the world do you run one of those businesses right now? Marketplace's Andy Euler checks in from Austin, long a bar town of some repute.
Mere minutes after opening its doors last Thursday at midnight, the Blind Pig Pub was already filling up. This bar with a dance floor and big rooftop patio is on 6th Street. That's Austin's version of Bourbon Street. I caught up with 25-year-old Taylor Blount on his way inside.
I think it is a little nuts. It doesn't seem like anyone's social distancing. I mean, people are kind of over it at this point, it seems.
Over the idea of avoiding 6th Street. He's not wearing a mask, but says he's comfortable being there. That's what Bob Woody is looking for. He owns the Blind Pig. I met him there later in the week when things were a bit calmer, and he ran down the things they're doing to help people feel safe.
We get him to the front door, the doorman's wearing a mask or a shield, and he's got a spray. And we're going to spray your hands, and if you don't want them sprayed, you can go someplace else, but we're going to spray them. That's our policy.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott issued his own set of bar policy suggestions last week. Things like bars should only operate at 25%, tables should be 6 feet apart, and hand sanitizer should be readily available. Woody opened the Blind Pig Pub the second he was allowed to. Craig Premisich is waiting for a minute. He's a partner in 2 Austin bars, Javelina and Nickel City.
You know, we're obviously motivated for the bottom line and to make the business sustainable, but, you know, we don't need to be the first. Let's see how the customer base is sort of responding, reacting.
How customers react could be the most important thing in determining what bars are going to look like, because the guidelines the governor issued aren't hard and fast rules. Michael Klein is president of the Texas Bar and Nightclub Alliance.
Governor Abbott purposely used words like suggest and recommend so that there's more interpretation and it's not as hard of a hammer.
In practice, it's really up to the individual bars to make sure people are safe.
We're expecting our bar owners to have a master's in public health and figure it out.
Peter Hotez studies molecular virology and microbiology at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston.
What would be ideal would be if, you know, a business owner could call a hotline and ask someone to come out and inspect their facility and give them recommendations. It's okay here. Okay, you should be doing X, Y, and Z.
For now, Bob Woody at the Blind Pig says he'll just do his best to follow whatever recommendations the governor's giving him.
I've made the promise that I will not close again. If you're compromised in any way, get in a safe place. I'm going to open, and people can make a decision to walk past this place or come in.
He hopes to get his bar to at least half its pre-COVID-19 capacity in a few days' time. In Austin, Texas, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
There are not, right at this very moment, too many options for a getaway. A quick break, someplace different to change your pace. But that doesn't mean you can't daydream about it. Mariel Segarra did.
I was sitting on the couch the other day watching TV, another day stuck in the house, and I saw this ad for Scotland. It starts with a gorgeous coastline view and then runs through the country's greatest hits. Castles, lochs, historic ruins, even a Shetland pony with a big puff of hair on its head. And then the tagline.
Absence makes the heart grow fonder.
The ad comes from the country's tourism board, Visit Scotland. Gwen Reyes, who does marketing for the board, says they wanted to reach the people who are stuck at home right now.
And what we wanted to say to them with this video is you really need to think about getting Scotland on your list.
Ads like this one are everywhere. Indonesia's tourism board is sharing photos of the country's national parks with the hashtag Travel Tomorrow. It has competition from Germany, South Africa, Mexico, and Switzerland, which has its own tagline, Dream Now, Travel Later. Claudio Zemp works for the Swiss tourism board.
We wanted to be in contact with our guests. We wanted to be talking to them, making sure that we are thinking of them, that they're knowing that we're waiting for them.
And while they're waiting, Zemp and his colleagues are not above tempting you with some dreamy visuals of a train ride through the Swiss Alps. Switzerland, like a lot of other countries, relies on tourist dollars. Henry Hartevelt is a travel industry analyst at Atmosphere Research Group.
In some countries, tourism can account for 20%, even 30% of their GDP.
In Switzerland, the tourism industry is just about 3% of GDP, but it's also a big source of jobs in small towns. And Hartevelt says if it seems a little early to be luring tourists, considering the pandemic, keep in mind,
especially international travel has a longer lead time and there may be more logistics to consider. They need to start doing this now.
Even though, he says, some places might not see overseas travelers until next year. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a quick callback to that Q&A Fed Chair Jay Powell did this morning. I was talking about up at the top. Alan Blinder, as I said, a professor of economics at Princeton, an occasional guest on this program, by the way, was doing the questioning. Those two have known each other, I'm sure, for 20 years, probably more. So they were mostly softballs, but still interesting. Here's one, Blinder asking the question from when they were just warming up.
So this is your 45th reunion, and congratulations on that, by the way. Did you take Economics 101 at Princeton, and do you remember who taught it to you way back then?
I did. Burton Malkiel taught it. I took micro and macro, as a matter of fact, my freshman year. Those were the only econ courses I took, though.
Two more than me, I'll tell you that. All right, we're going. Here's your moment of economic context to end the week. Inflation in this economy, or rather, the lack thereof. An indicator known as the core personal consumption expenditure, the Federal Reserve's favored measure of inflation, came out this morning, down 0.4% in April from a month earlier. So no inflation now. Thinking about what we said earlier this week? Go study disinflation again, would you? Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend. Get outside if you can. Stay safe. Wash your hands. All that good stuff. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.